Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, a conversation with Eric Larson from Writers on a New England Stage. Larson's best-selling nonfiction books, like Devil in the White City and Thunderstruck, are known for being meticulously researched and for reading more like novels than history. His most recent, In the Garden of Beasts, is set in Berlin, beginning in 1933, the year Hitler became chancellor. American Ambassador to Germany William Dodd and his family are intimate witnesses to the oppression and terror that rose along with the Third Reich. Eric Larson took the stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth as Dreadnought played Ride of the Valkyries and spoke with the live audience about discovering the character of William Dodd and his daughter Martha, an indiscriminate flirt. But first, he recalled another unwritten history, his first book tour.
Thank you. I'm totally thrilled to be here and to actually have a really large crowd and music. I mean, this is really great because it makes me actually very nostalgic for my very first book event. My very first book was The Naked Consumer. Wait a minute, did somebody actually read it? That is a book that nobody bought, nobody read. Well, actually, I'm sorry, one guy read it and reviewed it and hated it. And the reason he hated it was because he was a target of the book. It was about how companies spy on individual consumers. But I was living in Baltimore at the time, and I did actually get a call after the book had been out for a while, and I was despondent. I got a call to go and do a signing at a bookstore in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I've since learned, by the way, that Sunday afternoon book signings are death. That Sunday afternoon book signings on the first warm Sunday, after a hard winter, are really especially so. But anyway, I thought, now my career is going to take off. So I go up there, and it's one of these signings where you're stuck at the table at the back of the bookstore with about 30 or 40 of your books, right, on this table. The idea being that people will flock to you in droves, and you will sign their books, and since the books are then defaced, that they will have to buy them, and everybody will be happy. Mercifully, somebody at this bookstore had made a plate of chocolate chip cookies. And I put them on the table because God knew nobody's going to buy this book without an inducement. But here's the thing. I sat there in this store for about an hour and a half with nobody even making eye contact. People were looking at the books around me on the shelves, you know, and they would pull their children away. It's just... But at about the hour and a half point, I looked up, and this woman was coming towards me with a big smile on her face. So I start pulling out my pen. Now I'm on my way. And she comes up to the table, and she says, "How much are the cookies?" So tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about In the Garden of Beasts, this new book of mine, and try to give you a sense of how I think about ideas and also what really most surprised me. First, though, I want to do, because I want to give you a flavor for the book, I want to do a brief reading, about 28 pages or so. I need to know how many hearts sank when I said I was going to do a reading. I would rather have a vasectomy without anesthetic than hear another writer read his or her own work. And actually, if I had PowerPoint, I would give you a visual, but they didn't provide a screen. So, In the Garden of Beasts. The idea process for me is actually a very difficult time. It usually takes me really about a year from the time I finish one book before I can get another idea off the ground. It's sufficiently hard. My kids know it. My wife knows it. They all hate it. I hate it. My great friend and publicist, Penny Simon, has come up with a term for this. She refers to it as that time when I'm in the dark country of no ideas. The dark country of no ideas. And the reason it's hard to find these ideas is that what I really look for are ideas, you know, actual historical events, whatever, that can be broken down into their DNA, if you will, and reassembled in such a way that we as readers can live the event as it unfolded, you know, to an extent the way people at the time actually lived the event, you know, without knowing the ending. My favorite model for this kind of book, a book that magically is back on the New York Times bestseller list, is A Night to Remember by Walter Lord, which, as many of you know, is a book about the Titanic. I have read that book probably 4 times. Each time I read it, I think to myself, I hope that this time the Titanic will not sink. Which is, in fact, the magic of reading. I mean, I have the same feeling. Another favorite nonfiction book is The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman. Every time I read that, and I've read that a number of times as well, I find myself saying, you know, these people cannot be so stupid as to let World War I happen. And, of course, World War I happens. But one day, about 5 years ago, I was in that dark country of no ideas. And the thing I hate most about that is that I feel very unproductive. And so I just decided, you know, I got to jumpstart my thinking. So I went out to a bookstore near my home just to browse the history section, to see what was new coming out, what covers moved me, what covers turned me off, what was just sort of interesting. Came across a book, Face Out, on the shelf that I'd always meant to read, but it was always kind of intimidating. You know, 1,200 pages, tiny type, no photographs. It's not the Bible, no. It was The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Shire. Took the book home, read it, loved the book. Loved it because it really kind of read like a thriller, and actually it still holds up very well. But as I was reading it, I had this sort of miniature epiphany. And that was, you know, here was William Shire, the author. He had come to Berlin in March of 1934, and had, of course, stayed there as a correspondent for the rest of that time, and then later became a war correspondent during World War II. But what occurred to me is that when he was there in those early days of Berlin, he would socialize with these people we know today to be the absolute icons of evil, people like Goering and Goebbels and Himmler and Heydrich and so forth. He would interview Hitler, he would have lunch with Goebbels and Goering and so forth. But my little epiphany had to do with the fact that when he did that, at the time he was actually doing that, nobody knew the ending. Nobody knew where this story was going to go. And I started wondering, what would that have been like to have been in Berlin in these early days of Hitler's rule? What would that have been like to have socialized with these people? Would I have had any sense of what was coming down the pike? If I was sitting in one of Berlin's fantastic cafes and I saw Hitler being driven by in his open car, would I feel a thrill? Would I feel terror? Or would it have just been the most routine of moments? So I started thinking about doing a book to really satisfy my own curiosity about that period, try to capture a sense of that growing darkness of the age. I knew that to do so, I would need some real-life characters, a couple of real-life characters, ideally outsiders, ideally American outsiders, because I write primarily for an American audience. So I hit the library. And I have to say that, and if there are any librarians out there, I am a huge, huge fan of libraries. In fact, I love libraries so much. If you gave me a choice between a night alone with Cate Blanchett or a night locked alone in the Library of Congress, I would take the night with Cate Blanchett in a heartbeat. But I love libraries. So the first thing I did, and what, you know, most writers of nonfiction would do, is, you know, I started reading the grand histories. For example, Alan Bullock's classic, Hitler, A Study in Tyranny. The great works of modern scholarship by, for example, Sir Ian Kershaw and Richard Evans. Then circling in kind of like a moth to a flame to the more intimate histories, like published diaries, published letters, and things like that. I can't tell you exactly when it happened, but at some point I came across a man named William E. Dodd, his diary. And soon afterwards I came across a memoir by his daughter, Martha. And it was at that point that I knew, on an instinctive level that these were going to be my characters for this story. Okay, so imagine for a moment. You are William E. Dodd. You are 63 years old. You are a mild-mannered professor of history at the University of Chicago, chairman of your department. And you are tired of academia. All you want to do is finish your own book, a multi-volume series about the Old South, which you have titled, weirdly and appropriately, The Rise and Fall of the Old South. Suddenly, one hot day at noon, precisely, your telephone rings in your office. You pick up the phone, and the guy at the other end is Franklin Delano Roosevelt, newly elected president of the United States. So Roosevelt asks you to be the next ambassador to Germany. This is a post that at this point has been vacant for about 5 months. And here's the thing. He gives you 2 hours to decide. What you don't know, and what he neglects to tell you, is that one reason he's calling you is because nobody else wanted the job. He has offered it to many others by now. 3 weeks later, you are on the ship to Germany. You have brought your family with you, a grown son, your wife, and your 24-year-old daughter, Martha. And she is one heck of a daughter. I mean, you know, talk about 50 Shades of Grey. You know, should we talk about 50 Shades of Grey? Should we? So, but you know, I am the father. I'm the father of three daughters, and I can tell you that on the one hand, I am so glad that Martha was not one of my daughters. But I tell you also, as a writer, I am so glad I found her. I mean, she's just terrific. You know, frankly, I would have actually liked. I'd like to have had dinner with her in Berlin. I might have gotten lucky, like the rest of the Third Reich did. I mean, you know, it's. But she is the one. She's the one who hooked me. I mean, here she is. You know, she's smart. She's sexy, and she has this thing, this sexual charisma. She has this capacity to inflame the passions of men, both young and not so young. By the age of 24, she has had an affair with Carl Sandburg, the Carl Sandburg, at that point about 55 years old. She's also broken two engagements to be married. She is in the midst of a dead marriage to a New York banker. I didn't know there was any other kind of marriage to a New York banker. I did promise myself to leave politics out of this completely, by the way. So anyway, so Martha comes along to Berlin, and this is the thing that really, I really was so hard for me to get my mind around, but that made me really think she'd be an ideal character. She goes along to Berlin for the adventure, arrives, and she falls in love with the Nazi revolution, as she calls it. And here's the thing, she was not alone. An awful lot of people in this time thought Hitler might be good for Germany. You could quarrel with his methods, you know, I'd say, but maybe he was just the guy to bring Germany out of its post-World War I malaise. In fact, on the last night in America, the Dodds gathered earlier that day in New York so they could catch their ship the next day. But that night, they gathered at the, they went to a fabulous dinner party at the home of Charles R. Crane. On Park Avenue, a very wealthy philanthropist. His family made their money off plumbing supplies. Throughout the dinner conversation, Charles Crane is taking a very much a pro-Hitler stance, very pro-Hitler. At the end of the dinner, he takes Dodd aside, and he gives him a little parting advice. He tells him, let Hitler have his way. He also advises him a little later that when he gets to Berlin, he should not have any interaction with Jews because this will only hamper his ability to deal with the Third Reich. Her father arrives, hell-bent on being objective, not to prejudge the Reich, exhibiting a kind of willful ignorance that, in fact, the world at large seemed to be exhibiting at the same time. He expects to find rational statesmen. It's his historical training. He knows from his studies that statesmen are at least on some level smart and rational. They do crazy things, but they're fundamentally smart, rational men. He comes to Berlin and gradually realizes that There's no rationality here. It's pathology, organic pathology. These people are, in fact, crazy. His consul general, George Messerschmidt, not to be confused with Willy Messerschmidt, wrote in a lengthy, that's all he could do, write lengthy dispatches. His nickname was 40 Pages George. He wrote in a lengthy confidential dispatch that in any other time or culture, these top three guys, Hitler, Goering, and Goebbels, would be receiving treatment in an asylum. And that was actually even before the Dodds' arrival in July of 1933. Tell you what I found most frightening. That was how quickly Germany changed. This happened very quickly and in very sort of quiet behind-the-scenes way often, and sometimes not so quiet behind the scenes. But, you know, things happened so quickly that you could go away on a business trip. And, of course, business trips were a bit longer in those days, I mean, especially if you went overseas. But let's say you went on a business trip, you were gone for a couple of weeks. You might return to your hometown and find everything changed. And it's not because you're Jewish necessarily, but in one way or another, it's been decided that you are out of line with the Nazi ethos. So you could come back to your hometown and find lifelong friends who suddenly would not talk to you, shopkeepers who would not deal with you. You would also find people, neighbors, you know, people once friendly with each other, ratting each other out to the Gestapo, a new agency as of April of 1933, ratting each other out to the Gestapo to essentially resolve petty jealousies of their own. Let's say you envied your neighbor's house. You might call up the Gestapo or send them an anonymous note or something and say, hey, my neighbor said something nasty about Hitler. And the Gestapo was such, even then, such a suffocating entity that it would investigate. Things got so bad in 1933 that even Hitler complained. He told his justice minister, and I quote, "We are living in a sea of denunciations and human meanness." This is Adolf Hitler, 1933. Happily, and perhaps strangely, but much to my relief, let me tell you, this book has found a large and enthusiastic audience. And I think partly it's because a lot of people all along the political spectrum see a resonance in some event today. At the left, there are those who are afraid of the Tea Party. I give a lot of talks at synagogues, and the congregations are universally terrified of the president of Iran, and I don't blame them. I'm a little perplexed about it. At the extreme right, there are those who, believe it or not, see Obama as the reincarnation of Hitler. Now, I heard that laugh, but you know, if you doubt me, go home tonight, fire up Google, type in Obama and Hitler in the same window and see what you come up with. I think you're going to be in for a chilling evening. And you know, what's the thing that makes people think that Obama is Hitler? Healthcare. Now, I'm a fledgling Hitler scholar, but I can tell you one thing. The last thing on Hitler's mind was healthcare.
Best-selling author Eric Larson discussing In the Garden of Beasts live at the Portsmouth Music Hall for the Writers on a New England Stage series. When we return, we'll talk with him about American isolationism, the accuracy of eyewitnesses, and the dual nature of discovering new stories about Nazi Germany.
There were always two of me, I like to think. You know, there was the good me, you know, who would recognize how sad an event was, right? And then there's the bad me that sat on this shoulder would say, God, this is great stuff.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for more Eric Larson from Writers on a New England Stage on Word of Mouth and NHPR.
If old balls you like, if old hymns you like, if fair limbs you like, if Mae West you like, or me undressed you like, why nobody will oppose. When every night the set that's smart is intruding and nudist parties in studio, anything goes. When the Mrs. Ned McLean, God bless her, can get Russian red to yes, then I suppose anything goes.
When Rockefeller still can hoard enough money to let Max Gordon produce his show, anything goes.